Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the standoff between the FBI and Apple over access to the data on a cell phone belonging to one of the San Bernardino terrorists. With most of the country probably siding with the FBI over Apple, we will speak with Mark Rottenberg, the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C., about the larger constitutional and privacy issues involved in this case that might change the minds of those who see this through the lens of the war on terror and have concluded that Apple is failing to recognize the clear and present danger that terrorists pose, when in fact, Apple is making a stand for all of us and what we stand for. Then we'll speak with Jane Mayer, a staff writer with The New Yorker, whose latest book is Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. We will discuss the enormous success a few billionaires have had in moving America to the right over the past few decades, to the point where we are at a critical juncture in America as to whether we are still a democracy or have become more of a plutocracy, where instead of a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, we have become a government of the money, for the money, and by the money. Then finally, we'll go to South Carolina and speak with Danielle Vinson, a professor of political science at Furman University in South Carolina and author of local media coverage of Congress and its members. We will discuss the latest polls that have Donald Trump, who just picked a fight with the Pope, ahead in the polls for Saturday's Republican primary by double digits over Cruz and then Rubio, who has been endorsed by the state's popular governor. We will also assess whether picking a fight with the Pope will hurt Trump or help him. And joining us now is Mark Rottenberg, who's the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Rottenberg.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks, Mark. And it would seem to me that this sort of standoff between the federal government, the FBI, and Apple's and Apple CEO Tim Cook, it really does need some explanation, because I was just watching a town hall last night on MSNBC with Donald Trump, and frankly, it was a real sort of softballed event or non-event. But the issue of the FBI needing to get into this phone belonging to a terrorist who killed 14 people in San Bernardino, the way that it was immediately dismissed as this is a no-brainer, you know, national security should override privacy, and he completely thinks Apple's wrong. And I suspect that Donald Trump's response is pretty much what a lot of the average Americans are thinking out there when it's framed in that terms of, you know, we need to get inside a terrorist telephone. How come Apple's blocking it?
Well, I think people who have that view don't understand the technology or the Bill of Rights or the U.S. Constitution, for that matter. The problem here is far more complex than simply getting access to evidence in an investigation. In fact, Apple has already turned over to the FBI all of the relevant evidence that the company has for the investigation to assist law enforcement, and they've been very clear about that. So this is certainly not a situation where a company is saying that they're not concerned about the significance of the act or the need to work with law enforcement. What's actually happened in this search request is something that's quite extraordinary, almost unprecedented, in fact, which is that the FBI is saying to an American company, we want you to develop a technique so that we can get access to certain information, even though we know as a consequence of asking you to do this, you will be placing the privacy and security of all of your customers at risk. Because that's the technological implication of the FBI proposal. In other words, they want Apple to create a master key that's never been created before. They say they will only use it, at least for now in this circumstance, but of course once that master key is created, then all of the Apple devices can be opened by the FBI and by others. And I think Tim Cook's response is a very sensible response. I think it's a response that shows a deep commitment to the security and privacy of Americans, certainly not disrespect for the FBI. And it surprises me, actually, that people who are speaking about the issue don't understand the technological implications, or for that matter, the security implications of what's being proposed. Now, I'm happy to speak also about the legal issues, but just based, Ian, on the summary description that you provided at the outset, I think it's very important to understand the difference between asking a company to provide information that's relevant to an investigation, which Apple has already provided here, and asking a company to take steps that places all of their customers at risk. That's what Apple is opposing.
So specifically then, what is going on with this phone that they found? Clearly the two terrorists in San Bernardino destroyed, I think, two cell phones, and there was a period when they were dredging a lake looking for a cell phone. But from my understanding is this was a third cell phone that wasn't destroyed, and they're trying to open it up, and it has some password protection. And I believe if you try 10 times and fail, then all the data is automatically erased, that's a built-in component into the phone. Then the question would be, why is Apple not helping them, or is Apple helping them get into that particular phone, as opposed to ask for a key to open all phones?
Well, it's actually one and the same. And again, there seems to be quite a bit of confusion on this point, but let's try to say it again more directly. Apple has designed the iPhone so that only the user, the person who has the phone, you know, the registered person who set up the password, is able to get access to the contents of the phone. That's the way the phone has been designed. And it means that Apple can't get access. It means that the FBI can't get access. It means that criminal hackers can't get access. It means that people engaged in industrial espionage can't get access.
Or if you lose the phone, the person who finds it or steals it can't get access.
That's a very good example, in fact, because that's a common problem, by the way. People do lose their phones, and then they have to worry. They think, oh, my banking records are here, my social security number's here, all of this very personal information that contributes to the problem of identity theft, which is one of the top concerns, by the way, today of American consumers. We have unprecedented levels in this country of data breach and identity theft. And so all of these measures have been taken to protect consumers. And, of course, consumers have the option, as many do, to back up their phones to the iCloud, which gives them a copy, also makes available to law enforcement a copy, but some people choose not to, in which case all the relevant information simply resides on the phone. So it's very important to understand, as we're talking about the technology, that the phone is not designed to give Apple, the FBI, a person who finds the phone, or anyone else access to the contents. Now, the FBI comes along, and they have a real dilemma. I mean, you know, they do want access to the phone. We're not disputing that. But they say to the company, which hasn't designed the phone in this way, we need you to, in effect, design some malicious code that can be uploaded to the device to trick it into recognizing us as an authorized user, so that we now have the ability to gain access to the contents of the phone. Now, this is where it gets interesting, you see, because there's nothing about the phone per se that's unique. In other words, the software that you would write would open the suspect's phone, it would open another iPhone 5C user's phone, and it turns out, in fact, based on information that's come out today, that essentially every iPhone, including the iPhone 6 and the new OS 9, would also be subject to this attack. So now, in creating this technique, this master key to gain access to that one person's phone and authorizing it through the Apple digital signature, you've now created the technique that will break all phones. And as I said, the vulnerability here is just unbelievable. I mean, anyone who's involved in the project, any Apple engineer, would be in a position, you know, either through blackmail or extortion or just pure payment, to put at risk every single iPhone user in the world. And that's a very real risk. So I think that explains why it is Apple is so very reluctant to do what the FBI is proposing. And I'm frankly surprised that the FBI is pursuing this. They may feel that they have very compelling facts based on the horrific events in San Bernardino. But what they're not telling the public is the risk that it's going to create to other iPhone users around the world.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Rottenberg, who's the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. So it sounds as though, my understanding is that a fingerprint is also another way to access, isn't it, phones?
Yes, and again, the fingerprint, which is a form of biometric identification, is information that's stored only on the phone. So right. Apple doesn't have the ability to recreate, just like the passcode, Apple doesn't have the ability to recreate the passcode. It also doesn't have the ability to recreate the fingerprint. These devices are by design intended to be secure.
Right.
That means you don't have extra keys lying about. I wanted to just share with you an analogy. There's also been a lot of discussion trying to, explain what the consequences of the FBI proposal is. And just to share with your listeners another way to think about this, you can imagine a neighborhood that's dealing with a lot of crime and the police having a fair amount of difficulty getting into homes after crime occurs to conduct investigations. So they could say, for example, well, why don't you please keep a copy of the front door key under the doormat so in the case that your home is burglarized, we'll have the ability to easily enter your home even if someone's not there. And in practical circumstances, if there is a crime at 100 Main Street, it will give the police easier access to the home because they'll find the key under the doormat. But the obvious point is, of course, with the key under the doormat, anyone would have access to the homes in the neighborhood, and the level of crime would likely increase. So in trying to accommodate a request to make the investigation easier, you can actually increase the likelihood of crime when you introduce a new vulnerability. And it's very similar, in fact, to what's being proposed for the iPhone.
But it sounds as though the FBI, I think they maybe found this phone after the San Bernardino terrorists were buried, because they could use the corpse's fingerprint, obviously, to open the phone. And perhaps they didn't take a mold or imprint of the fingerprints. I don't understand that aspect to it. If that's what would get around this, since you've already made it clear that it's not a case of the Apple engineers saying, here's a way that we can open this particular phone, because in opening this particular phone, they have to open all phones, and that's the very reason why Tim Cook and Apple are making this stand.
Well, that is the practical consequence. As I read the order, and as Apple has interpreted it, the technique that would make it possible to gain access to a phone that's not designed for third-party access is the same technique that would make access by a third party to any iPhone. So
therein is the...
It's a very clear line. And we've talked in quite a bit so far about the technology. I think it's also, in response to some of the criticisms that have been made. I mean, as I said, I think they're not well-informed on the technology front. I think they're also not well-informed on the Bill of Rights, U.S. Constitution front. I mean, the framers of the Constitution had very strong opinions about the powers of government. And our Fourth Amendment came about in response to the writs of assistance and general warrants that had given the British authorities unbounded search powers over the people living in the colonies. In effect, the British police would have the ability, by designating a person as the target of a warrant, to search all manner of persons and effects without regard to any particular crime they might have committed. So in drafting the Fourth Amendment, I believe what the framers tried to do was to be very precise about the justification that the government would need to establish to get access to evidence. And most importantly, the Fourth Amendment is drafted in such a way so as to put the obligations on the government to ensure that it has provided the necessary information to justify the search. There's no language in the Fourth Amendment that says to private citizen or a private company, you have a responsibility to make the government's work easier. And this, to me, is in some respects the most ironic part of the criticisms that have been directed here about Apple's conduct. It is entirely in keeping with the Fourth Amendment tradition of this country, the constitutional tradition of this country, not to use search authority as a way to coerce private conduct. It would be upside down, in fact, to argue that, and it's only in very rare circumstances that those claims are made, which brings us, in fact, back to the warrant in this case. It relies on the All Writs Act, which is from the 18th century, and it's what the government turns to when they have no other familiar legal basis to try to compel compliance with search authority. And it's a real red flag here that there's something going on here that's not normal.
It's also clear, though, that the fact that the redcoats would kick the doors down and rifle through a person's private home and papers, etc., isn't that the inspiration for the Fourth Amendment? I can't remember the exact words, but it guarantees privacy of persons and papers.
I mean, but this is again the point that I'm trying to make with regard to the political arguments here. The political argument, if you care about the country's constitutional tradition, if you care about the liberty tradition, it would be suspicious of the FBI's conduct, not of the private company's conduct.
So, in turn, I started the interview out with you, Mark, posing this, eternal question that goes back, I guess, to Benjamin Franklin's famous adage that he who would exchange liberty for temporary security deserves neither. The argument has reemerged, and that there's a lot of posturing going on with the sort of, national security hawks basically saying they've got the right argument, and this is just irresponsible on the part of Apple. I think you've given us a lot of ammunition to explode that idea. But going forward, what's your bet, though, in terms of this political year and all the posturing? Whose argument's going to win, Apple's or the national security state?
Well, I hope it's not framed simply as a trade-off. I genuinely believe that if you have a thoughtful reason policy discussion, oftentimes you can achieve both objectives. And it's certainly the case that the FBI today has access to far more information than it's had in the past. Even in the context of this investigation, the fact that Apple did have a backed-up version of the phone and made it available to the FBI and all the data that represents, I'm sure is much, much more than the Bureau would have had in a similar investigation just 5 years ago. So it's not a zero-sum situation. I think the question is simply, is it possible to draw any lines? And if we are drawing lines, do they make sense? I think the line that Apple has drawn here makes a lot of sense. And I think even for people on the national security side, if they stop and think about it for a moment, the consequence of going along with the Bureau's proposal in this particular investigation really could place U.S. firms and U.S. government agencies and U.S. consumers at risk. When this issue was debated 20 years ago, we had almost exactly the same alignment of discussion. And, after a lot of consideration, it was people in the government, people who were in the law enforcement community and the intelligence community, who ultimately concluded this is a dangerous road for us to go down. So I think that's the best outcome. I think on this particular situation, the right thing, I think, would be for the Bureau to say it's just placing too many people at risk to create this kind of vulnerability in such a widely used communications device.
I thank you very much for joining us here today, Mark Rotenberg.
Nice speaking with you.
Thank you, Mark. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Rottenberg, who's the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Jane Mayer, a staff writer with The New Yorker, whose latest book is Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidi-bidi-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bidi-bidi-rich, idle-diddle-diddle-diddle-man, I'd...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jane Mayer, a staff writer for The New Yorker, specializing in political and investigative reporting. She's the author of three best-selling nonfiction books, including The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. And her latest book just out is Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jane Mayer.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. And you have made an enormous contribution here to unearthing the political secrets behind this juggernaut of money that has been unleashed since Citizens United. But in a way, the big change, as far as I can see, in the recent history of the United States, you could make the case that from 1947 to 1977, the U.S. had a kind of social democracy, not the one that Bernie Sanders talks about in Denmark, but something along those lines. And then with the advent of Ronald Reagan, the tables have turned, and now our democracy looks much more like a plutocracy, and we are less of a democracy and more of an oligarchy, it would seem. So it seems to me that much of the other players in your books, not just the Koch brothers, indicate they sort of emerge out of this change that's taken place. Would you say the change took place, began under Ronald Reagan?
Well, first of all, I'm very happy to hear you mention that there are other players besides the Koch brothers, because the Koch brothers certainly are the best known of these. But there was a small group of disenchanted billionaires, most of who had corporate fortunes, several of whose fortunes were just inherited, who felt if you want to break down American political history to sort of before Reagan's period, they were really disenchanted with what was going on before Reagan, and really they were actually a Goldwater supporters who felt very disappointed when he was not elected. And so this batch of sort of far right super wealthy people were casting about to try to figure out how they could change American politics. And they began a project that really started at least 40 years ago to use their fortunes to try to change the whole course of American political history. And so Reagan's election could be seen as an important turning point, but for the Kochs in particular, I think something that maybe your listeners would be interested in is that Reagan was nowhere near far right enough for them. David Koch ran against Ronald Reagan on the Libertarian ticket in 1980 because David Koch and his brother Charles did not think that Reagan was conservative enough. And so they wanted to see America go far to the right of where Reagan was. And they've been working on trying to bring it that way.
But, of course, the Goldwater defeat, and that was, of course, a huge wipeout for the Republicans. But arguably 16 years later, Ronald Reagan essentially had the Goldwater platform. But perhaps it's more to do with the self-serving nature of plutocratic interests, even though you say, in terms of the plutocrats, one of their core beliefs is that taxes are a form of tyranny and that government oversight of business is an assault on freedom, and that these beliefs are sincerely held. But nevertheless, in all of the cases of the oligarchs that you portray in Dark Money, their ideology also coincides with the bottom line in terms of more profits.
Well, you know, there's been a growing concern about whether the America is sort of on the edge of becoming somewhat oligarchic. And you get smart people, economists and social scientists asking this, and even, you know, some Republicans talking about it. I have a quote in the book from one of the political advisors to George W. Bush, who talks about how, you know, he fears that America is becoming an oligarchy. It's not out of the question, I think, at this point. And what I was going to say is that it then sort of begs the question of what is it that oligarchies look like? And there's a very interesting political scientist at Northwestern University named Jeffrey Winters, who's written a book on oligarchy that compares what oligarchs are like around the world. And what he writes is that, for the most part, they favor policies that lead to the accumulation of their own wealth. The major policies that they support are ones that protect and defend their fortunes. And you could look at the Kochs and some of these other sort of conservative big donors as in that light, as being sort of aligned with that kind of thinking. They, of course, will not say that's what they're doing, though. I mean, they describe themselves as involved in politics for altruistic reasons, saying that they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars in order to make the country a better place, not to just, increase their bottom line.
And again, I'm speaking with Jane Mayer, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker, specializing in political and investigative reporting. She's the author of three best-selling nonfiction books, including The Dark Side, The Inside Story of How the War on Terror Turned into a War on American Ideals. And her latest book just out is Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. But in terms of the reason I brought up the notion that there was a sort of social democracy in the United States from 47 to 77, coming out of Roosevelt and World War II, and now you have people like, and you mentioned some other conservatives warning about an oligarchy. Warren Buffett, of course, famously warned that we're in danger of becoming a plantation economy. And what is their vision, though? I mean, I think the new romantics, liberals are always cast as dreamers and romantics, but the true romantics today, I think, are the libertarians. They have
In a way, I agree with you there, Ian, that it's a very strange philosophy that is, in some ways, from their standpoint, utopian. The idea that Charles Koch has, and he is a serious ideologue. I mean, this is someone who, I mean, somewhat self-taught, but he's read, you know, tons of political philosophy, and he is very extreme in his views. And what he believes is that the free market is the sort of the source of wisdom, and that it will settle all disputes most equitably, and that it's the best system for people to thrive. And and I'm not just talking about capitalism, which, obviously America is a capitalist country. What I'm talking about is the free market that's unmoderated by government regulations for the most part, and very few laws, very little government at all. It's very close to anarchy, what he believes in. And the reason it's kind of a sort of a fantasy is, of course, there really isn't such a thing. There is no commerce without laws that enforce contracts and private property and, you know, ownership and that sort of mediate disputes between people. The free market is just kind of a concept that it will never really exist completely without some kind of, you know, mitigation.
Well, of course, the irony is, as much as the Kochs and other billionaires and the groups that he's gotten together at these secret conclaves, there was just a recent one out here in Palm Springs just recently, they have vilified Barack Obama, and prior to that, of course, Richard Mellon Scaife, who you also profile in your new book, Dark Money, went after the Clintons with a vengeance. Is that something to do with the age-old idea that wealthy people want passive and obedient political agents that they essentially think politicians are just the whores and hirelings of the wealthy and powerful, and that if they're tame, like, say, a Marco Rubio, who'll do what Sheldon Adelson tells him, or a Ted Cruz, who will do the bidding of whoever, because he's obviously a deeply cynical person. But at least in a way, it seemed that Clinton and Obama offend them in a way that is really quite deep and visceral.
Well, that's a very interesting question, because you are right that when you see what Charles Koch has said about politicians over the years, he has contempt for them and for politics itself. And he regards them, I mean, literally there's a description of in a book about him where they say that the Kochs regarded politicians as just actors. And what they wanted to do was, they don't want to just hire the actors, and they don't want to be the actors. They want to write the script. And so they've been figuring out how to tell the politicians what to do. I mean, it shows, you know, a certain contempt for politicians and for the idea of public service. And maybe you're right that part of the reason that Clinton and Obama have offended that ideology so is both Clinton and Obama really believe in public service. They think it's a noble profession, and they think the government does good. And that is the, you know, the polar opposite of really where the Kochs are. As libertarians, they think of the government as the enemy, and that businessmen are the smart people and the ones who do good in the world.
Well, without beating a dead horse over social democracy, the point that seems pretty inescapable to me was that the period that we're talking about, 1947 to 1977, if you go back to that wonderful movie, post-war movie, The Best Years of Our Lives, and then you go through the period of the American Dream under Eisenhower, it's worth noting that under Eisenhower, the very wealthiest were paying 92% tax. And so it's little wonder to me that the Koch's father, Fred Koch, the founder or co-founder of the John Birch Society, thought that Eisenhower was a communist.
Well, and Fred Koch, the father of the Koch brothers, tangled with the IRS and wound up having to pay a big fine to the IRS and regarded taxes, again, as a kind of a theft from himself. And the sons were brought up in that atmosphere. I mean, this is a family that made its fortune in fossil fuels, was based originally in Wichita, where Charles Koch still lives, Wichita, Kansas. And they regarded the American government almost in the same way they looked at sort of the Soviet Union as a kind of a force for evil that was going to sap Americans of their energy. And that is the way that they were brought up. They were, the sons, like the father, were members of the John Birch Society, and they saw statism as kind of a communist conspiracy.
But it's such an irony to think that, as your new book points out, Jane Mayer, Dark Money, the hidden history of the billionaires behind the rise of the radical right, that the source of the genesis of the family fortune comes from the great dictators of history and certainly of the 20th century. Fred Koch built oil refineries for Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
That's right. I mean, and what an irony for a family that prides itself as being libertarian and anti-statist. The family fortune springs from two of the most absolutely tyrannical, authoritarian dictators that the modern world has seen. So, I mean, the people I interviewed told me that the father Koch, Fred, came back after working for Stalin and felt quite guilt-stricken about what he had done, and so that this contributed to his staunch sort of anti-communism, what he'd seen there, and the fact that he'd made money off of this sort of murderous dictator. So, you know, I mean, it's a very tangled history. You could hardly make up something like this. I mean, and the Hitler chapter was not really known until my book came out, and that too was just amazing. The Father Koch helped build and design a refinery that had to be personally greenlighted by Adolf Hitler in the years right before World War II. And then that refinery was key to the Nazi war effort, so that because it was able to refine fuel in such a way that it was high-octane fuel for the Air Force, the Nazi Luftwaffe. So, again, I mean, the legacy of that, it just casts such a shadow over this famous American company and family.
But it wasn't just that he left Nazi Germany with a good chunk of change from Adolf Hitler for this refinery that refined high-octane fuel for the Luftwaffe. He brought back a governess for the Koch boys, this absolutely prototypical Nazi. I mean, she sounds sort of like a German version of Nurse Ratched.
She's terrifying to the boys. I mean, I found that the research that I did on the family was just so stunning that people still talked in the family about how they had the oldest boys, the Koch brothers, Fred, the younger Fred, he was the oldest son, and then Charles, who was really the driving force in the politics of the family. Those two boys were brought up by a nanny who literally was a fervid Nazi, and she was such a supporter of Hitler's that in 1940 she went back to Germany because Hitler had invaded France, and she was so excited she wanted to be with him to celebrate at that moment. By then she'd been with the family for 5 years and helped sort of bring up those two oldest boys, and she scared them tremendously. Apparently she was very, very strict and demanding and controlling, and the parents, who were wealthy, were often gone and traveling, and so the little boys were left in her hands.
Well, it's difficult not to make the extrapolation that an ardent Nazi might have sort of unloaded some of her ideology on the boys, or at least influenced them in some way, not to suggest that they're in any way fascist. But
well, I think you have to say, just to be fair, and, you know, in this situation, the father, Koch, he was not an, at least one doesn't know what his views of the Nazis were, and after World War II started, he offered to enlist on the American side. He was too old, though, but I mean, before one gets too carried away with the whole thing, and I think it's, you could also argue plausibly that the effect of having a Nazi nanny might just drive someone in absolutely the opposite direction, and who knows, maybe the strict kind of rule of terror she imposed on those little boys is partly what made Charles Koch so rebellious as a child. And as a young adult, he was thrown out of school something like 8 times. And his ideology, of course, libertarianism, is one that is in rebellion against authority in a certain way. So who knows? I'm not a psychiatrist. It's hard to know what goes on in someone's mind and how people's political views are formed. But it was an unusual childhood that these boys had.
But in terms of the dark secrets in Dark Money about the family, the fact that they, within the family, there was the sensitive boy that was sort of outed, accused of being gay, and that essentially his brothers stole his fortune, or stole his chunk of the father's fortune.
Well, they tried to blackmail him, four brothers altogether, and three of them, according to a sealed deposition, tried to corner the fourth, accuse him of being gay, and it's just told him that if he didn't hand over his share of the family fortune, then they would go to their father and out him as gay, and that he would be disinherited. So, I mean, I think what you can see from that is the fighting within this family, even at an early age. The Koch brothers were pretty ruthless, very competitive, very driven, and had their eye on building fortunes. And there wasn't a lot of love lost among these brothers.
Well, now, of course, we're in this election year, and lo and behold, we have an actual bona fide oligarch, billionaire, running for president, and he's doing remarkably well. And I imagine the Kochs are tearing their hair out, even though he's a fellow billionaire.
Well, he may be a fellow billionaire, but he doesn't necessarily share all of their political views, and that is the problem with Donald Trump for the Koch brothers. They've put together a donor group that's something like 400 or 500 of the richest conservatives in the country. They've pooled their resources, and they said that they've set aside a budget of $889 million that they want to spend in the 2016 election cycle. they were not planning to get involved in the Republican primary, so they're kind of sitting there on the sidelines. But meanwhile, the one candidate on the Republican side that really is not in need of their backing seems to be at the forefront of the pack, and that's Donald Trump. And so this is a real conundrum for them. And the rest of the Republican candidates have gone to their donor groups and begged for their backing, but Donald Trump has kind of made fun of them and described the other Republican candidates as puppets.
Well, not entirely inaccurate, I think, in terms of at least the way they all sort of stoop before the popes and kiss the ring and do the same for Adelson. Well, Jane Mayer, I thank you so much for joining us here today, and I thank you for your book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right.
Well, great to be with you, Ian.
Thank you again. And I've been speaking with Jane Mayer, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker, specializing in political and investigative reporting. She's the author of three best-selling nonfiction books, including The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. And her latest book just out is Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to South Carolina for the latest in the Republican primary race ahead of Saturday's voting.
There's a place out on the edge of town, sir, rising above the factories and the fields. Ever since I was a child, I can't remember the mansion on the hill.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Danielle Vinson, who is a professor of political science at Furman University in South Carolina, where she served as the chair of the political science department from 2009 to 2015. She's the author of Local Media Coverage of Congress and Its Members, and is currently working on a book that looks at how Congress has used media to influence policymaking over the last 30 years. Welcome to Background Briefing, Danielle Vinson.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And there's quite a slugfest going on in your state on the Republican side. Of course, a week later, the Democrats vote a week from Saturday. But coming up to Saturday's Republican primary, Fox News has a poll out today that has Donald Trump with a double-digit lead of 32% over Senator Ted Cruz, who's at 19%, and Senator Marco Rubio is at 15%, and former governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, is down at 9%, in spite of the fact that his brother, the former president, George W. Bush, campaigned for him. So let's begin with that apparent, well, I guess it was a failure in terms of the brother giving the brother a bump.
It looks like it in that poll. I've seen three other polls today, though, and they're kind of all over the place. Some of them have had Bush as high as 14 or 15%. So the polls are still kind of varying. And I think one of the things that we're still trying to see in that sort of Bush-Kasich-Rubio group is the support for all three of them is very fluid right now. And I think for Bush, you know, his brother being in town was helpful, but Rubio's endorsement from Governor Haley kind of blunted that a little bit. But Bush is bringing more family members back for the rest of the week, so he still will get at least some attention. Now, whether that actually turns into votes or not, we shall see.
Well, judging by the extraordinarily wide, glowing grin on Marco Rubio's face as he stood on the stage with the Governor Nikki Haley, who I believe is at, 80% approval rating in South Carolina.
Yeah, this is interesting. My colleagues and I were talking about this today because Governor Haley clearly has a wonderful reputation outside the state, and she's got high approval in the state, but it's not completely clear to us how much her endorsement matters to individual voters. in the state. So we're kind of interested to see if that really does allow Rubio to gain some of those Bush votes. I'm still hearing from some people around here who have been waffling back and forth between Rubio and Bush that they're a little bit nervous about how Rubio would do against a Hillary Clinton when it comes to questions of experience. And they feel like Bush is stronger on that, but they do like the fact that Rubio's got the fresh face. And I think Nikki Haley was looking at that and wanting to attach herself to sort of that new face of the Republican Party.
But Rubio's sort of lowered the bar, hasn't he? He's more or less saying that I'll be happy with third place.
Oh, yes. Well, I think that's smart because it right now everything I've seen points to Trump winning, and the question is, can Cruz make it close so that he can continue beyond South Carolina, or is this that race between Trump and Cruz for the outsiders, those that want somebody who doesn't really seem to be part of the Washington establishment, I think that race may well get decided in South Carolina. If Cruz can't keep it close, I don't really see his rationale for continuing. But there is definitely a second race going on, and that's that's the race for the vote for everybody that doesn't want Trump or Cruz. And I think there's still a significant number of Republican voters who are very nervous about a possibility of a Trump nomination, and they're looking towards those folks that have a little bit more experience, the governors or either Rubio, to be an alternative to Trump or to Cruz from that outside group.
Well, this has been a very extraordinary and unpredictable election year so far, so I think that's a major caveat that we all should have. But I must say, picking a fight with the Pope is a pretty amazing political turn of events, wouldn't you say?
It is. It may not hurt him as much in South Carolina as it will going forward. We have more evangelical voters than Catholic voters in the state. And so picking that fight here might be all right, but I think when you start moving on to some of these more heavily Catholic states, that could potentially backfire.
But what about the fact that the fight itself is over immigration, in the sense that the Pope was referring to not building walls but building bridges, and he was clearly referring to the border. Won't that revisit immigration, which is Marco Rubio's vulnerability?
Yeah, I think that's a good point because, the folks that support Trump, they're happy to take on the Pope on immigration, too. The fact that they're supporting Trump is an indicator they want the wall built. But I think for those others in the Republican Party who are participating in all these primaries who want a more pragmatic stand on immigration and who also are looking at the long-term health and future of the Republican Party with Hispanic voters, those people are looking for an alternative, and yes, Rubio is going to have to get real comfortable and figure out what his position is on that, because he has run from the compromise or bipartisan bill that he helped work on in the Senate, and that becomes a bit of a challenge for him to figure out what position he's really going to take, and he does become vulnerable because he worked on the compromise and then seems to have backed away from it.
And again, I'm speaking with Danielle Vincent, who's a professor of political science at Furman University in South Carolina, where she served as the chair of the political science department from 2009 to 2015. She's the author of Local Media Coverage of Congress and Its Members, and is currently working on a book that looks at how Congress has used media to influence policymaking over the last 30 years. So let's do a breakdown then of the constituencies here in the Republican vote in South Carolina. I'm familiar with the evangelical constituency, which is often put at 60 or 65%, and then the other constituency that is also often referred to is the veterans or military vote. So, what would the other constituencies be?
Yeah, South Carolina is interesting, and I think it gets as much prominence as it does because it's a bit of a microcosm of the Republican Party. You have the two groups that you mentioned, but we've got a lot of other things going on here. We have a very strong sort of traditional conservative business component to the Republican Party in South Carolina, which is partly why the Bushes have done so well here in past primaries. They were often running against more maverick upstart candidates, and it was that business traditional wing of the party that saved them. You also have more recently, a very strong Tea Party component in the South Carolina Republican Party. And you have a lot of transplants and retirees from the Northeast and Midwest along our coastal regions. Even our Republicans along the coast tend to be a little bit more environmentally or interested more in environmental affairs and are sometimes seen as more moderate on those issues than conservatives elsewhere in the state, which adds an interesting dimension to politics down there. So we've got kind of a little bit of everything except probably the Hispanic vote in the state.
And what about the state's reputation as being having sharp elbows, mudslinging, the Lee Atwater political operatives, and that kind of reputation? I don't see that much of it happening this year. Is it certainly?
Oh my! You need to be here.
So tell us about it. Tell us about it.
It's gotten uglier by the day. We had mostly avoided it until this week, and I started noticing it. A lot of it's coming from the super PACs. And it's in the ads, and particularly the ads on radio. In fact, the Rubio PAC, Conservative Solutions, they came out with an ad on radio this week, which essentially tries to link Clinton and Bush, and this is Bush for bringing his family in to campaign for him. But basically, it's, you know, that's the politics of yesterday, and it's time to look forward, and we can't go back. And it's hard. It's a tough ad. We've had a lot of negative ads on television, getting a lot of phone calls. And that's where this really gets ugly, is because the phone calls are usually not on the media's radar screen. They see the ads on the internet and stuff, but they're often not clued into the phone calls. And I've gotten a lot of phone calls in the last week from various supporters of this candidate, that candidate, some of them paid for by candidate campaigns, some of them paid for by the super PACs, that are really going after people, and in some cases potentially distorting some records. And trying to link Jeb Bush with Barack Obama because Jeb Bush supported Common Core, a little bit of a stretch there. There have been some pretty heavy-hitting phone calls against Cruz, and there's some mailings out there that have been pretty tough on John Kasich and also on Rubio. So we are still getting quite some nastiness. And then the candidates have been openly calling each other liars during their appearances in the state this week.
That has certainly been noticed. Although I must say I watched the MSNBC town hall last night with Donald Trump, and it was less than exacting, I must say. A lot of softball questions. I don't know that he got exposed to too much criticism, and certainly nobody in that audience asking him anything but friendly questions. So that may be the other side of the coin there. But how do you explain that Trump, with the evangelical vote, he's getting 31% of it compared to Cruz getting 23% and Rubio 17%. And the veteran military vote, they favor Trump as commander-in-chief by 37% over 22% for Cruz and 15% for Rubio.
Two things there. One is that the evangelicals and the military vote have never really hung together in this state. We talk about them as the evangelical vote or the military vote. They almost always divide among the candidates, and they divide for interesting reasons. Part of the evangelical vote is there are a lot of people describing themselves as evangelical who hold very different theological views. And sort of a new group and an older group, and they don't quite see eye to eye on the issues when you start translating that faith to public policy. So my hunch is Trump is probably not getting a lot of the older evangelical vote, maybe some of the newer and more, you know, 30-ish group. But I also think the other thing that's driving a lot of that Trump support is just anger and frustration. People are tired of the way Washington works, and you know, they see someone who sounds different, and they're like, let's give him a try. And I, you know, a lot of evangelicals have been frustrated by things that Washington couldn't do. So, you know, it didn't prevent the acceptance of gay marriage, for example. And a lot of evangelicals see that as a failure, and they're hoping that somebody from the outside may shift that. But I also think some of that splitting of votes is voters trying to figure out who's got the best chance of beating Hillary Clinton. And they're not convinced that some of the more traditional candidates can do it, or they've got doubts about one candidate or the other.
Well, the poll that I'm citing is a poll from Fox News that came out mm-hmm. today, Daniel Vinson. Now, you mentioned that the Tea Party is another constituency there. That, I think, pretty seems to be also going in Trump's favor. Mm-hmm. It is an open primary, isn't it? It's not restricted.
Yes, it is.
So that means the independents can vote.
It means the Democrats can vote in it if they want to.
And would that mean causing trouble, you mean?
They could, well, either that or deciding that if a Republican were to win in the general election, they might want the better of the options.
Right.
Our Democrats have done both of those things over the years.
Right.
We do not have any sort of registration by party identified on our registration cards, and they will not ask you whether you're a Democrat or Republican when you show up to vote. They'll just make it clear that you can only vote in one or the other, and you have to choose.
Well, it would seem, though, that favors Trump, doesn't it? He seems to be bringing out independents and some people who haven't voted before, and I'm not sure how many of them. They may be conservative but not Republican, right?
It seems that one of the polls that I saw today that was breaking that down, the folks that were not Republicans who suggested they were likely to vote in the Republican primary, that vote seemed to be splitting between Trump and Kasich. So it does seem to be either a group that's trying to make mischief or they like Trump, or a group that's trying to save themselves from Trump.
So what's your sense then? And now I'm putting you on the spot, I know. But what's your sense of how this is going to play out? Because it's clearly got some serious national attention, and it's amazing how the Republicans have this year, their debates have gotten enormous ratings, and I think the eyes of the nation are going to be on South Carolina on Saturday.
Yes. I have no reason to think Trump is not going to win. His support of everybody seems to be the most solid. I expect turnout's going to be high, which probably favors him or maybe helps Cruz as well. Cruz has got a tremendous ground game in the state. So we'll see how well that compares to Trump. But I would expect Trump to win. In that other race for the alternate to Trump, my hunch is Rubio is going to come out ahead of that. And if Bush doesn't keep it close, then that's probably going to give Rubio a good bit of momentum going forward to stay in the race and try to be that alternative to Trump.
But
if Bush keeps it close,
then
we continue to have a muddle going forward.
But it has to be close for Bush. At what point does he recognize reality?
If he's not within a few points of Rubio, then I would expect that he'll get out. If he's within a couple of points of him, then he can make the argument to stay in because of the immigration issue, because of the experience factor. But if he's not within a couple of points of Rubio, I don't see him continuing on.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your insight here. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Danielle Vinson, who's a professor of political science at Furman University in South Carolina, where she served as the chair of the political science department from 2009 to 2015. She's the author of Local Media Coverage of Congress and Its Members, and is currently working on a book that looks at how Congress has used media to influence policymaking over the last 30 years. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.